Hello, this is Lauren Chang, Managing Editor at Competition Policy International. As part of our Spring 2012 issue, CPI is presenting a retrospective of our best articles in the past and providing updates. One of our selections is antitrust sanctions, originally appearing in the Fall 2010 issue of the journal. Doug Ginsberg and Josh Wright, the two co-authors, are here to discuss developments since the article was published. They will also be exploring some of the issues raised in depth, but first, some background information on the authors. Douglas H. Ginsberg is a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, to which he was appointed by President Reagan in 1986, and which he served as chief judge from 2001 to 2008. He is also a professor of law at NYU and visiting professor at University College London Faculty of Laws. Judge Ginsberg was previously a professor at Harvard Law School and Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Antitrust Division of the United States Department of Justice. Josh Wright is a professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. His areas of expertise cover antitrust, law and economics, consumer protection, and intellectual property. Josh has published dozens of law review articles and co-edited three books, Pioneers of Law and Economics, Competition Policy and Patent Law Under Uncertainty, and the Research Handbook in the Law and Economics of the Family. He is the co-editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review and also serves on the editorial advisory board of our own Antitrust Chronicle.
Could you provide an update on what trends have continued or changed since you wrote Antitrust Sanctions? In particular, has the use of fines continued to rise in frequency as well as amount? And does incarceration continue to lag behind fines as an antitrust sanction?
This is Doug. It's not so much a matter of frequency as it is the amount of the fines and whether the fine is still the usual sanction in most jurisdictions, which it is. I have no doubt that the amounts have continued to increase. Certainly hasn't fallen off. In fact, not long ago, the Mexican Competition Authority imposed a fine of $1 billion.
I would add, this is Josh, it's certainly the case that incarceration trends in the U.S. have remained relatively stable since the article, both in terms of average length of sentences and the rate of incarceration. For our purposes, in the article, the most important trend has been that the mix of sanctions between corporate fines and jail and no use of debarment in the U.S. and the EU has remained relatively constant.
That's right. Since we wrote, though, Mexico has instituted a system of criminal sanctions, and Japan has increased the penalty for criminal antitrust violation, but I don't think there's been a criminal case concluded in either of those jurisdictions.
You propose shifting high fines away from the corporation in favor of increasing fines on the individual wrongdoers of the firm as a more optimal sanction. But since you've written the article, anti-corporation sentiment has flared up, as seen with the anti-Occupy movements and so on. So given this more hostile climate, and also considering any type of political atmosphere, are there any adjustments you'd now make to account for public reception?
No, if the analysis was right when we wrote it, then it's still right now. You're certainly correct that the political environment has changed a bit, but that might actually make it more likely that individuals would be sanctioned in jurisdictions where previously it was only the companies that were sanctioned. After all, the individuals that were at the helm of some major companies have come in for a large share of criticism over the last several years, as have their companies.
Another point here is that our proposals to adjust the mix of sanctions, holding constant the level of corporate fines, and to increase accountability or culpability for individuals within the firm. Professor Harrington, in his response to our article in CPI, incorrectly presumed our proposal would require a reduction in current levels of corporate fines. But it may well be the case that a reduction would improve the efficiency of deterrence if coupled with an increase in individual accountability and debarment. But our proposal begins with, we think, the modest observation that increases in corporate fines haven't been associated with any marginal gains in deterrence, and that holding corporate fines at current levels, the same shift in the mix of sanctions would improve deterrence. Perhaps the fact that the corporate fines remain constant might make the move more rather than less palatable in the current environment, as Doug just observed. I agree that if the analysis was right on the merits, then it remains so. But it's worth pointing out, as we do in the paper, the shift in debarment would be consistent with modern trends in the U.S., where we're already moving towards an increase in criminal sanctions and individual accountability. Recall the evolution of debarment as a sanction that the SEC for white-collar crime arose out of the SEC's decision to start pursuing it rather than any legislative action. That general trend toward greater individual sanctions hasn't been coupled with debarment thus far in the antitrust context, at least here in the U.S., but it has been adopted as an antitrust sanction in other countries. And we even have it here in the U.S. at other agencies, and indeed even right down the road at the Federal Trade Commission for different types of violations. It may only be a matter of time until the DOJ takes a closer look at adding debarment to the enforcement toolkit.
Is there a concern that with a sanction like debarment or, the focus on the individual, that it might actually be kind of productive because it might possibly be seen as a shaming penalty or a form of scapegoating that would be distasteful?
Well, if it's the individual that's engaging in the criminal violations, shaming seems to me quite appropriate. Individuals are going to have limited resources available for fines, which punish their families as well as them individually. So there's a good case for a modest amount of jail time, and the shame of jail is certainly much greater than it is for any other individual sanction. I think that's been an important source of deterrence for individuals ever since the Department of Justice started seeking real jail time, not just very short sentences that could often be suspended, but some real time in jail starting in the mid-1980s and increasing since then.
I'd like to add two additional related points when thinking about the economics of reputational sanctions and the efficacy of deterrence. The first, as we discussed in our article, is that the constant increase in corporate fines occurring over the past 20 years doesn't appear to have generated much bang for the buck in the way of marginal deterrence. When we talk about adding another penalty to the mix and the reputational sanctions that are likely to come along with the debarment, the economist immediately turns to the compared to what question. If there are potential fairness concerns with increasing individual penalties, even if they produce greater deterrence, one must compare that system with the current one of ever-increasing corporate fines. Recall that the corporate fines are borne in large part by passive shareholders and consumers, neither of whom seem particularly fair targets for penalties. Measuring these things in the antitrust context, in terms of fairness, is a mixed bag, and is at least one reason why in antitrust, thinking about deterrence and in line with the consumer welfare standard is a much more fruitful avenue of thought. Certainly, it's the avenue of thought that DOJ has in mind and that's responsible for this, at least starting their shift toward increasing individual accountability. The second important economic point is that one of the benefits of increasing reputational sanctions for price fixing as an offense cuts in the other direction. The greater the reputational sanction, the less, for any specific given level of a deterrence, is required to achieve efficient or optimal deterrence. The economic logic is that we can rely to a lesser extent upon more inefficient methods of deterrence, which tax passive shareholders and consumers. We can aim the deterrence more directly at the perpetrator, who's in position to stop the offense, in this case, price fixing. So there's an efficiency gain as well. And one way to think about that efficiency gain is the marginal gain from increasing the reputational sanction. We believe debarment's not in use as an antitrust sanction at all in the U.S. currently, but there's much more to gain there in terms of increasing reputational sanctions from its current level of zero sort of to marginally move up the scale to one or two than a further dollar increase in the level of corporate fines, which are already at very high levels.
If you're working at a corporation and there's some gray area in your line of work, an example that you use is non-collusive vertical restraints versus price fixing. And let's say you yourself are not sure whether what you're doing is an antitrust violation. How do you take this into account when formulating an appropriate punishment model?
Like the enforcement agencies that have criminal sanctions available, of course, led by the U.S., but now also in Canada, the U.K., Australia, and a few others, have been appropriately quite careful never to bring a criminal case where the conduct is in a gray area, where it's just anything other than naked price fixing or maybe market division, and where any reasonable person would know that they're violating the law. As soon as you get into a gray area, it's appropriate to bring a civil action, not a criminal action. And only when it's been clarified that what may have been gray in the past is now actually black and out of bounds, then would it be appropriate to bring a criminal case. So a noteworthy example of how this has been practiced by the Antitrust Division is the much-publicized current filing involving Apple and some book publishers, which was brought as a civil case because it's not just a bunch of competitors getting together and fixing prices. It's something that we haven't seen before, a little bit different, and required the department to proceed cautiously.
The Apple example is a good one. It's an example where, in addition to some agreement or alleged agreement among publishers in the DOJ's complaint, you've got other factors going on that make the DOJ, although they allege in the complaint horizontal conspiracy, you've got some also factors suggesting that there's this complication and a move toward a new business model. The agreement may not be directly on price. It may be to move something like the agency model, something more akin to an agreement among rivals to adopt resale price maintenance. But no further agreement on what the minimum prices will be. It's a more complicated arrangement. The technology is more complicated. The involvement's more complicated. So in these sorts of cases, the DOJ, even in the presence of a horizontal agreement, or what they allege is horizontal agreement, doesn't bring criminal cases. Second example that comes to mind involves FTC invitation to collude cases. Although the FTC doesn't have authority to pursue a criminal case, it certainly can refer those cases to the Department of Justice. But in its invitation to collude cases, rather than refer them to DOJ for criminal investigation, largely what's done is to pursue those cases under Section 5 of the FTC Act and treat them a little bit differently. We're in that gray area, somewhere short of what appears to be a plain vanilla hardcore cartel offense, that would traditionally be the subject of criminal jurisdiction. So I think the stance of the agencies, the United States at least, is to exercise appropriate caution in making use of criminal sanctions.
To follow up on what Josh was saying, soliciting a price-fixing agreement was first litigated here in the American Airlines case of 1984 in the Fifth Circuit. If you recall, there the president of American Airlines called the president of Braniff and suggested that they fix prices, but the president of Braniff instead taped the conversation and sent it to the New York Times, which put it on the front page. It wasn't entirely clear, however, until the Fifth Circuit made it clear that this was a violation of the Sherman Act. Now the FTC has brought a number of cases. I think the department would be entirely justified if it had a clean-cut solicitation case to bring it as a criminal case. The public's on notice that it's a flat-out violation of the Sherman Act, not a gray area anymore, even though it was 25 years ago.
And lastly, could you speak a bit on how your proposal has been received in the European Union?
Well, the problem is that the European Commission has a very limited toolkit. They don't have, at the European level, a criminal sanction. I don't think they have any specific authorization for debarment, but, of course, if that seems to be the right thing to do, they could seek that authorization. So they're, I think, quite limited at present, but potentially interested in some new ideas, at least I hope so.
Great. Thank you for taking the time to provide an update on your article, Antitrust Sanctions, and it's been great talking to the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.